Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Reyes, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Renee Werke presiding.
Good morning, everyone. And if I didn't greet you, I want to say thank you and good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals and the Zoom Gov method of having oral arguments presented. Today is January 26, 2021. We have a mixed calendar of oral argument presentations as well as non-oral cases. The rules of appellate procedure still apply in these audio hearings. However, if you choose to be seated, you don't need to stand. I want to remind you when you're not speaking to have your microphone muted, and that way we have a little better ability to keep track of people speaking over each other and making a record of the proceedings. When you begin your presentation of your case, please state your name and indicate which client you're speaking on behalf of. With that said, I'm going to ask Mr. Prentice to call our first case for consideration.
This is case number A200401, State of Minnesota versus Jordan Jermaine McCray.
Mr. Peterson, when you're ready, you have the floor.
Yes, Your Honor. Before I begin, can I reserve two minutes for rebuttal?
You actually, under the rules of appellate procedure, will have 5 minutes. You don't have to use all of the 5 minutes, but you will have 5 minutes.
Sounds good. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Josh Peterson. I'm appearing today on behalf of the appellant, Mr. McCray. The district court in this case erred by denying Mr. McCray's motion to suppress evidence found as a result of a Terry stop. A Terry stop that the state argued to the district court was justified based on the collective knowledge doctrine. That's right. The stop at issue in this case was made based on a report from another officer in another county. The arresting officer had no personal knowledge of the underlying incident that supposedly justified the search or the stop. By the time Mr. McCray was stopped, the report was 2 months old, and perhaps most importantly, the report was no longer accurate. There was no active pickup and hold request for Mr. McCray.
Mr. Peterson, can I stop you there? Didn't the officer have firsthand knowledge? Wasn't he personally aware of the warrant?
He had firsthand knowledge that there was a pickup and hold request, Your Honor, but right. He had no knowledge of the underlying facts that justified that pickup and hold request. And therefore,
why
they're relying.
Why does language pickup and hold? Where does that come from? Because that is confusing, especially to people that may be individual lawyers that are reviewing this case. It doesn't sound like a warrant. Is that just the vernacular of the St. Paul Police Department?
Your Honor, my understanding is, I believe it's out of Dakota County, and my understanding is that a pickup and hold request was essentially a warrant out for his request, or a warrant out for his arrest.
As far as appellant's issues that are raised, you're not claiming that there wasn't a you're not claiming that there was reference to something other than a warrant. Is that right?
That's right, Your Honor. Yes,
all right,
that's correct.
So let me ask you this question. I think it was Officer Real, maybe I have the wrong officer, but I understood that he was familiar with your client, with McCray, because of either prior encounters or just simply familiarity. Did he know anything other than the fact a possible warrant was out? Did he know what it was for? Did he know where it was from? Did he know the individuals that were involved?
The testimony on this subject was sort of brief from the officer, but what we know is that he heard, I believe it was over dispatch, that there was a pickup and hold request for Mr. McCray. It was out of Dakota County. The officer testified that the sole reason that he stopped Mr. McCray was based on that pickup and hold
request. All right, so there's no testimony or information that he knew what the pickup and hold was. And what I'm getting at, it could have been for failure to appear. It could have been for a misdemeanor offense. Did the officer have any knowledge, or was any knowledge imputed to him as far as what was the seriousness of the warrant?
I think your last point there is very good about the imputation of knowledge. But the first point to answer that question, yes, he did testify that he knew it was a domestic violence incident, was the underlying incident. As far as imputation, that goes to the core of our argument, Your Honor, which is that under the collective knowledge doctrine, all information that the police had related to any sort of justification for the stop of Mr. McRae was imputed to Officer Real, the officer that performed the Terry stop in this case. And of course, this court has applied the collective knowledge doctrine in the Terry stop context several times. We cited those cases in our brief. So have the federal circuit courts.
I'm not following your argument on that because I understood that. What knowledge are you imputing to the officer here? I mean, you're saying collective knowledge, but what knowledge?
So our key argument is that knowledge that the warrant was no longer active was imputed to the officer, given that the status of a warrant out for an individual's arrest is information that is kept and held and updated by the police. And because the police at large knew that there was no warrant out for Mr. McRae's arrest, that knowledge was imputed to the arresting officer, even if there was not actual communication of the status of his warrant. And that's the Lemieux case.
So, Mr. Peterson, speaking just for myself and not for the panel, I must say I'm a little worried about imputing knowledge that somehow collectively the police may have me. How do we define that to an officer? That seems pretty wide. But one thing that I do have questions about that was mentioned in the case you cite in your brief, and I would like Mr. Raggis to address this too, is in this situation where an officer has information about a past warrant, but knows it's dated. In looking at whether there's reasonable suspicion for a stop, should we be considering whether the officer had time to stop and check the warrant database? Is that something that should be part of our assessment of what's reasonable under the circumstances? If you both address that, I would appreciate it.
Your Honor, I think that absolutely the court should consider that. And of course, here it's our contention that the officer had plenty of time to check the status of the warrant. In fact, he was in the process, was his testimony, of checking the status of the warrant. He simply didn't finish that process, was his testimony, before he stopped Mr. McRae. If there is time like this case where you see an officer that sees someone he recognizes from past incidents, knows there's an active warrant or thinks there's an active warrant that he heard about 2 months prior, has time to drive down the street, has a partner with him in the squad car to check on the status of this pickup and hold request, goes all the way down, turns around, comes back. He has time to check the police database. And it's important that it's their database.
Was that established at the district court? Was that this issue argued to the district judge? Because when I looked through the transcript with the district court's findings, I just didn't see that referenced.
The reference to the amount of time that the officer had?
Amount of time and whether there was time to check the database.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that was argued. In fact, that was the subject of much of the cross-examination of the officer by the public defender in this case. And there was even a contention by the trial counsel that the officer could and actually did check the status, knew that it was not active, but arrested Mr. McRae anyway. The district court, I believe, did not find that to be credible, but that was an issue that was raised and argued because the officer, apparently there was a contention that the screen in the officer's squad car showed that he had looked up the status of the pickup and hold request. And I think it's a little bit simpler for this court if it goes down this route to say, look, the officer in this case, he could have looked it up in his squad car. He was in the process of it. He had time. It was not an emergency. And he, under those circumstances, he should have checked to see if it was active. Because if you look at this from Mr. McRae's perspective, he gets his warrant quashed. He goes to court and gets it taken care of. And then 2 months later, an officer he knows from a prior run-in in a different county in Wisconsin stops him. And by the way, in that run-in, that was a case this officer investigated and Mr. McRae was acquitted on. So there's a history between these two. And the officer testified that he believed he was a felon. He believed that he might have firearms on him. And of course, I mean, we see here that he's stopping and then he's asking, he's expanding the stop when we raise this issue in our brief too.
But Mr. Peterson, from a public safety perspective, we have an officer that testified that he believed there was a warrant. We certainly don't want officers to just keep on driving down the road and have someone who may be a danger to the public or to, in this case, a domestic violence victim without checking that status. So at what point do you think there should be some limits created to determine when, how much time? Is there any cases that you have that say how much time is too much, how much time is not enough? Do you have any cases that would give us some guidance on that?
Your Honor, I think you're absolutely right that we would hope that officers that hear about a warrant in the past should look up whether the status of that warrant and also investigate whether that individual should be arrested then and there. As far as drawing a line on time, I think the proper analysis is done with what Judge Jessen was talking about how much time an officer has to look up the status of that warrant before that individual is going to, say, disappear, exit the area, and no longer be subject to an arrest. As far as the 2 months time, I think it's difficult to draw an arbitrary line like that to say, look, an officer has to look at 2 months. It has to look up any warrant if it's less than a month or it's 2 months or 5 months. We did cite other cases from other jurisdictions, but it's unsurprising to me that this court has not been willing to draw a bright line rule of if the warrant is X many months old, then it does justify a search or it doesn't justify a search. And I contend that it's just not necessary in this case to draw that line, particularly here because we're dealing with knowledge the police have, the police keep, and it's clear the officer had time to check that the status of that warrant. And most importantly, under the collective knowledge doctrine, when an officer makes an arrest on knowledge that another officer had, that some other officer did this investigation, some other officer put out the pickup and hold request. If that happens, the officer...
You have to acknowledge that your client, Mr. McCray, could be considered a dangerous individual. I mean, he was a violent guy based on his history that we know, and he traded in guns or dealt in guns. And I mean, these are circumstances that an officer is aware of and takes into how they conduct themselves in connection with stopping an individual. Wouldn't you agree with that? I mean, this isn't a guy that has no record.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. But as far as, obviously, you can't stop somebody just because they have a record. You have to have something more. And, you know, assuming that the original stop is justified, assuming that somehow this officer, and let's assume that the warrant was actually active, if the stop was justified, we would not be arguing that he should not have performed a pat-down search. But here, and we're kind of getting into another issue, is once he performs that pat search and he finds there's no weapons on Mr. McCray, and he asks Mr. McCray, hey, is your warrant still outstanding? And this happened. Mr. McCray said, no, the warrant is not outstanding. Then the stop has to stop. It has to end. That's the end of the scope of a legitimate Terry stop.
But Mr.
instead,
Peterson?
He asks another question.
Mr. Peterson,
go ahead, Josh.
You bring up a point I wanted to follow up on, and it's actually kind of a follow up to the original question Judge Jessen had. At what point do you think the officers should have done the verification that the warrant was still active? Because I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there was testimony that the officer turned around was about 30 seconds, and that doesn't seem like a lot of time to do a search, a computer search, even if he's having his partner in the car do a search. At what point do you think the law would require the officer to verify that warrant is still active? After he pulls in front of the car and before he gets out of the car, the squad car, or after Mr. McCray says, the warrants, I don't have an outstanding warrant, after the pat-down search? At what point do you think that search, the verification of the warrant is required?
Your Honor, I think it has to happen before any sort of constitutional intrusion is made. Anything that implicates the Fourth Amendment, that's when the search should have been made. The search for the warrant status should have been done. That, in this case, that means probably before he parks in front of Mr. McCray's vehicle, before he does any sort of seizure of Mr. McCray. And here, what's also important, and I think Judge Jessen touched on this too, we aren't talking about an individual that's in the middle of a shootout. We aren't talking about an individual that's dealing drugs right in front of the officer. There's some sort of concern that he's going to flee. He's not even driving. We're dealing with a situation where the officer spots a suspect and he's at a gas station filling up his car. There's time here. Even if it didn't take the officer that long to get back to him, I think it was 30 seconds to a minute, the officer had time. He could have pulled over on the side of the road, spent 20 more seconds and just looked up the status of a warrant. And instead, he didn't. He just didn't. He stopped him and he found him.
Okay, so, I have another question about that as well. Let's assume for the sake of argument that he was justified in making the initial stop based on the knowledge that he had, whether it was mistaken or not. Why didn't the officers finding or smelling marijuana, why did that not justify them continuing the investigation? Isn't that evidence of ongoing criminal activity?
Your Honor, I hesitate to dive really deep into the issue of the odor of marijuana, which I think is too often a statement we hear from police officers to try to justify just about any seizure and search. But the truth is, in this case, it was not a key issue. It was something the officer did mention. It's not clear exactly when he smelled the odor of marijuana. But assuming there is case law, of course, Your Honor is aware of this. Assuming he did legitimately smell the odor of marijuana, that can justify an expansion of a search. You're absolutely correct. We just contend that the district court simply didn't rely on it in this case, and it wasn't a key issue.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. As you can see, your time has expired, but you'll have that rebuttal moment. And Mr. Ragatz, we look forward to hearing from you. You have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Thomas Ragatz. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I represent respondent state of Minnesota in this matter. I hope this morning mostly to address any questions this court has, but I do—
Well, I have a lot of questions. Of questions because, you know, all of the panel members have watched that body cam video. I mean, this was a guy that's standing there. He didn't flee. He didn't go into the bathroom or try to secrete himself. He did nothing. Why would this officer not have checked the veracity of that warrant before going up and engaging in discussion with this person?
It's an officer safety issue, Your Honor. The officer personally knew that there was a warrant out for this person on domestic abuse, not failure to show up. The warrant itself says that that appellant has access to weapons. The officer knew that this appellant had previously been involved in a shooting. So it's no surprise that when people are approached on a warrant, they may well decide to flee or arm themselves, or as happened in this case, to try and hide contraband.
Here, but the facts here are that he didn't. And I think what bothers me about watching the body cam video is there almost seems to be I don't want to call it a bantering relationship, but there doesn't look to be any fear about weapons between these two. It's like, hey, you know, I mean, they knew each other. They talked about you're still living somewhere. I mean, to me, this totally dispels any concern that this guy is going to take off. Plus, he's a heavy set guy. He's not going to go too fast. You know, you're imputing some fear in the officer that I don't think is established anywhere within this record. We learned about this after the fact, but because there was a gun. But if your officer hadn't checked the veracity of the weapon, how does he know there's guns involved?
Well, again, the warrant itself says that appellant has access to weapons. The officer knows that appellant has previously shot someone.
And this is a warrant that your officer doesn't know whether it's still valid or not. And it's 2 months old and it comes from a different county, not Ramsey County.
That's true, Your Honor. But as this court knows, 2-month-old warrants are not rare. I mean, in this case, we had a warrant for many, many months after appellant.
So where would you draw the line then as far as the temporal limits on this case? Where would you place the lines? I mean, could this have been 5 months and it would still be okay to pull this person over because of the weapons knowledge? A year? Is there anything that you should point out to us that would establish that?
Well, Your Honor, I think this is a case where you will often defer to trial judges who look at all of the circumstances. Here, as Judge Diamond pointed out, there isn't any case law that creates a hard and fast line. 2 months is not especially old, especially given the nature of the warrant here. And 30 seconds is not a long time. I mean, the officer thought that appellant had seen him. So once he parked in front of the car, appellant couldn't flee. And he did pat down appellant. So that shows that he was concerned about
the warrant. He did pat down the appellant, and eventually there's the opening of the wallet. He knew who he was. He knew his, he even said, what's your middle name again? I mean, this is an officer that, I mean, I hate to say close relationship, but it appears they did have a close relationship. There's no question about the identity of this guy. So I would assume that there's a better ability to check the veracity of a warrant instead of having to get identification, figure out who this person is, and see if he is actually the one that he recalled from being in a warrant.
Well, he does know appellant, and he knows that appellant has previously shot someone. So that's a pretty good reason not to delay, at the minimum, blocking the car in so appellant can't hop in the car and flee, and to pat him down right away to make sure appellant doesn't have a gun on him again. This is officer safety.
So why shouldn't the stop end at that point? The other officer said to him prior to that, we're just going to check real quick, and if everything looks okay, then we'll let you go on your way. They do, he checks, he parks in front of him, like you said, he does the pat search, and then he goes back to the squad car to check. It looks, at least from my perspective, it looks like he's checking the passenger's ID, but he certainly has the information on Mr. McCray. Why couldn't he at that time have checked to verify that the warrant is still active, that he does have justification to hold him, and if not, let him go?
Because, Your Honor, he'd already smelled marijuana at that point, and that's clear.
Well, but that's not, I think that was disputed, and did the district court actually find that the officer did in fact smell marijuana?
The district court noted that. It's on page 18 of my addendum. The officer clearly testified on page 18 and 19 of the transcript that at the time of the pat search, he smelled marijuana, and case law clearly says that's enough to continue a stop or to expand a stop. Appellant never argued below that what happened after the initial stop was invalid, expanded the scope of the stop. So Judge Diamond never made a ruling that the marijuana justified the continuation because that wasn't an issue before him. Appellant only argued two things below: no reasonable articulable suspicion to pull the car in front of the squad car in front of appellant's car, because that's what the stop was, and then that the pulling the marijuana out of his pockets was coerced consent. There was never an argument below of improper expansion of the scope of the stop. It was clearly justified by the marijuana. Appellant didn't testify. There was no contradictory evidence about the marijuana.
But we do have the video, and in the video, Mr. McCray says to the officer several times when he's pulled over, and the officer asks him about the warrant, Mr. McCray says unequivocally several times, there's no outstanding warrant. I went to court in January. I got that taken care of. There is no warrant. Why shouldn't now the officer is put on notice that that issue may be in dispute. And so why can't he, like, he actually went back. He patted him down, make sure for officer safety, certainly justified there. But why, when he went back to the squad car, why didn't he take the time to verify at that point whether the warrant was valid or not?
Because he'd already smelled the marijuana. So at that point, the warrant was irrelevant. The testimony couldn't be more clear. He smelled the marijuana at the time of the pat search. That's uncontradicted here. And again, appellant's main argument—
But that's not a finding by the district court. I mean, I understand your argument, but that's not a finding that we can rely on from the district court.
Well, that's because appellant didn't raise this issue below. Appellant never argued improper expansion of the scope of the stop. Appellant's argument was,
well,
the officer had no reason to pull the car up.
Your response to Judge Reyes is that that's the reason to expand the stop. You're the prosecutor. Isn't it your job to present that factoid to the trial court, if you will, that even though perhaps the warrant thing hadn't been resolved, that there was also that smell of marijuana? I mean, kind of like, if you don't believe this, what about that? I mean,
well, the officer, we did get the testimony from the officer about the marijuana smell, and it's not the prosecution's job to rebut arguments that the defense doesn't make. The defense's only argument here was the cop shouldn't have pulled up the car in front of the appellant's car in the first place. There was no reasonable articulable suspicion for that, which is the stop. The only other argument below was coerce consent on pulling the bag out of the pocket. And Judge
What if, and again, I am not speaking for the panel, what if we agree that the warrant was, whether it was stale or whether there was not a temporal connection between the happenings here, I mean, if we agree on that, isn't it then your responsibility to have proven that there was another secondary reason to continue the search, which would have been, of course, the smell?
Well, Your Honor, I think we're getting a couple issues sort of mixed up here. If the warrant wasn't valid, a valid basis for the stop, then everything goes away. I mean, everything that happens after the stop is the fruit of the poisonous tree. So the only real question here is, was the officer justified in doing that initial stop, which is blocking appellant's car? And the two arguments made below against that were he had a duty to check and it was stale. There wasn't any collective knowledge argument below. That's clear. I mean, there was never any argument that anything should be imputed to the officer. And in fact, that goes against a duty to check. If there's collective knowledge, he doesn't have to check. Who cares if he checks? Everything's automatically imputed. But there's no case law, if you're going to look at this under plain error, that says everything in the police computer is automatically imputed to the officer. You might impute what other officers know who are at the scene or are in communication, but that's not the situation here. So the only way to hold under these facts and these arguments that there was no reasonable articulable suspicion for the stop is to either find the warrant was per se stale or that the officer had a duty to check before doing anything. And as Judge Diamond found, there's no case law that supports either of those. And I think under the facts here, the officer did not have a duty to delay before blocking the car. Again,
well,
this is an officer safety issue.
Some specific legal terms by saying the officer had a duty. What about what would reasonably take place under these facts, circumstances, the totality of the circumstances? I mean, we're misplacing that and you're talking about a duty. I don't think there's a duty, but wouldn't we take, as an appellate panel, wouldn't we take into consideration all of the facts surrounding this matter?
Well, Your Honor, I ought to be clear here. The duty to check argument is the argument that appellant made below. I'm not creating that. That was their argument to Judge Diamond. The stop here was invalid because there was a legal duty to check and because the warrant was legally stale. Judge Diamond rejected both of those, and those are really the only issues then properly before this court. Yes, you do, under reasonable articulable suspicion, look at all of the facts here. And the facts are, this is an appellant who has previously shot someone. The warrant says he may be armed. He's known to have weapons. The warrant is for domestic abuse. The warrant is less than 2 months old, which, as this court knows, is not particularly old for a warrant. So under these facts, it was reasonable for the officer to act promptly and take the minimally invasive step of blocking the car.
I'd be remiss if I didn't say, because you refer to him as being dangerous because he shot someone, I remember the officer saying he was acquitted, not my words, not the officer's words, he was acquitted because of self-defense. But it seemed there was a little bit of a rankling with the officer in saying that he got off. But, you know, as far as your argument is concerned, he was acquitted of that offense, right?
Right, but he obviously had a weapon. If he shot someone, he must have had a gun on him. The warrant itself says that he's known to be armed. So for officer safety reasons, blocking the car so he can't flee and doing an immediate pat search is reasonable. I've never seen a court say, officers, we're gonna second guess you. You can't do something like this. You have to take more time to check on the status of the warrant under facts like these. Now, if appellant had been sitting at a restaurant, eating a meal, didn't see the officer, well, then it would probably have been reasonable for the officer to check first, but that's not the situation here. The officer drove by appellant, thought that appellant probably saw him. 30 seconds later, he's blocking the car.
What was the immediacy then? You say a restaurant would be different if he's sitting in there and having a sandwich. So what immediacy was present here where the guy is filling outside of the car, not even in the driver's seat, and the car isn't running? And what's the difference? You're eating a sandwich or you could run that way too.
My point was that in the restaurant situation, if he didn't see the officer, he didn't know the officer was coming, if he was in the middle of something. Here, A, he saw the officer, at least the officer reasonably believed that, and B, he's right next to his car. Clearly, he could jump into the car, grab a gun out of the car. He could do lots of different things that someone who doesn't even know an officer is present couldn't do. And this is a reasonableness determination. This is the sort of thing where you'd have to find that Judge Diamond erred under case law, and there isn't any case law that supports appellant's argument. There isn't any collective knowledge argument properly before this court. The smell of marijuana argument was not raised by the prosecutor below because appellant forfeited any expanding of the scope argument by not making it.
Mr. Reagans, let's assume for the sake of argument that the officer was justified in terms of pulling in front of the car and then going out and pat searching him. And let's assume for the sake of argument, there wasn't enough time, was not enough time to do a verification of the warrant to make sure that it was still active. Like I mentioned before, I'm still concerned about the fact that Mr. McCray said the warrant isn't active anymore. And it seems to put the officer on notice that he should verify whether it is, but let's assume for the sake of argument, but that even that's enough. And he's pat searching him to make sure there aren't any weapons on him. After the pat search, however, the officer says to him, quote, he asks him if there is anything on you. But he's already done a pat search. He's already done a pat search. And then he's asking him, is there anything on you? Why isn't that going above and beyond? Why isn't that coercive? And I believe this is an argument that was raised to the district court that the scope of the search had been expanded by that point and in induced him based on the totality of the circumstances of the stop and two officers there to start taking stuff out, showing that there's absolutely nothing else by taking all the other stuff out of his pants pockets.
Your Honor, the defense absolutely did not argue that the do you have anything on you question was an illegal expansion of the stop. They never argued that. They argued that the pulling the marijuana out of the pocket was coerced, but they never argued that. If they had, Judge Diamond would have ruled
right, but that's my point is that was coerced by the officer saying after the pat search, is there anything else on you?
Well, that's a question. That isn't a command to empty your pockets. I mean, that's what Judge Diamond found here. You'd have to find Judge Diamond's fact finding was clearly erroneous because Judge Diamond found that appellant thought he could pull most everything out of his pocket but hide the marijuana and therefore fool the officer. He did that voluntarily. The officer never said, please show me what's in your pocket. The officer never implied that. He asked a yes or no question, and appellant never argued below that yes or no question expanded the scope of the stop.
He argued it was coercive, though.
He argued that the pulling the bag out of the pocket was a coerced consent. He didn't argue that the question itself was an expansion of the scope of the stop. He essentially argued that he was forced to pull the bag out because of the officer's question. But Judge Ireland found that's not correct. And that's not a clearly erroneous finding of fact.
Well, but the officer after the after he started emptying out his pockets, the officer saw the bag of marijuana. He saw him put it back in. And then he said to him, what is that? Let me, take that out. Let me see that. And so that was a command to Mr. McCray at that point with respect to the bag of marijuana.
Well, right. But the defense agreed below that once he's seen the marijuana, then it's game over. I mean, after that, everything's clearly justified. The question is, was the seeing the marijuana in the first place a coerced consent when the officer never said, empty your pockets, never implied you need to empty your pockets, just said, do you have anything else on you? They never said that was expansion of the scope, because if they had, the officer could have explained. I asked that because, sometimes people have weapons on them that I can't feel on a rudimentary pat search. That was just not ever an issue here. And one of the striking things here is all these issues that appellant claims Judge Diamond just somehow forgot to rule on. And then the defense then forgot to say, hey, Judge Diamond, will you rule on this before we agree to stipulated facts? That's why so many of these issues here are waived, because they clearly weren't raised before Judge Diamond. If they had been, he would have ruled on them. He's not a dumb judge. And the defense isn't dumb. They would have, brought it up.
Is there such a thing? I need to point out that you're way over your time limit, but go ahead and sum up where you're at.
Your Honor, I'm sorry. I was just trying to answer the last question. I don't have any more unless the court has any more questions.
It appears not. Thank you, Mr. Reagans. And Mr. Peterson, as I indicated before, you have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to address what Mr. Reagans ended on, Judge Reyes touched on too. This sort of expansion consent issue, it's two sides of the same coin. And certainly there was an argument from the public defender that the question was the point where this stop expanded, unlawfully expanded. And we direct the court to the Savon case. I mean, that case is almost exactly like this one, except it's a traffic stop for, I believe, a broken taillight. The officer does what you'd expect. He approaches the individuals that are in the car. He asks for their license. He asks for their registration. He comes back. He goes to his squad car. He comes back. And that's when he asks the question, do you have anything in the car? It's almost exactly like what we're talking about here. Do you have anything on you? I think it's a bit disingenuous to say that that question was just about a gun that would have been found during a pat search or anything related to a domestic violence incident that allegedly occurred 2 months prior. That question is the beginning of a fishing expedition that was successful, luckily, for this officer. And certainly this issue was raised. There was even a finding from the district court on the issue. And even if it weren't raised, we can look at the plain error analysis. This is a plain error that was made. There is the Savon case is a published case on this very issue. It says you cannot expand a stop past the either search for weapons or the investigation of what justified the stop initially. That happened, and then the officer made the question or asked the question, do you have anything on you? I mean, the state makes much of this argument that basically plain error analysis applies and we win, but that's not how it works. If it's plain error, if that's truly the standard that applies, then under the Yang case, which the state relies on almost exclusively to make this argument and even briefed in a motion to strike, the Yang case is clear. It almost quotes the appellate rules. A reply brief is restricted to responding to what's in the response brief. The state says one standard review applies. We say another standard review applies. We argue in response to what they put in the response brief that the plain error analysis does not apply. And even if it does apply, we meet it. And we submit that we do meet it here, whether it's on the collective knowledge doctrine issue, whether it's on the expansion of the stop issue. And I urge the court to remember that this is a criminal case. Someone is serving time for this. We should not be doing this sort of lawyerly games to try to get out of considering whether the stop here was constitutional or not constitutional. It wasn't constitutional. It was made based on information kept by the police in its own servers, its own database. And that database said that the pick up and hold request, the warrant, was no longer active. And for those reasons, we ask that the court reverse the district court's decision. I'll obviously answer any questions that the panel has, but otherwise, that concludes my argument.
It appears there's no questions. I want to thank both attorneys for appearing today. It's always nice to see you and to hear your arguments on these kind of cases. The matters were well briefed as well as argued. A decision will be issued within the statutory timeframe.